Call meeting order. Representative Hoppe says he's ready.
Absolutely.
Folks, welcome back. Thank you for coming. This, you know, after we had the last, everybody was in tears, and there's a lot of hugging after the last meeting because we thought it was our last meeting. We decided we missed you all so darn much. We thought we'd throw in a little informational hearing. If you've seen the agenda, we've shaken it up a little bit because Representative Abler has the good fortune of being on a conference committee that starts at 10 o'clock. I've already chided him that if there's senators involved, that means it starts about 10:20. But we did put him at the top of the agenda so that we could hear his presentation of the bill. I understand, Representative Abler, then you will have to head off to your conference committee, but we'll take testimony after that. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you know, after the meeting, I was actually here at the end of the last meeting, and it was just a moment to share. And I wanted to bring a bill that would take that moment and even go beyond to one more level. And this is not the bill about the Minnesota Entertainment Center, which some call the Viking Stadium bill, but this has to do with something even more important. And, Mr. Chair, you are a co-author on the bill, so I think you'll be able to carry the bill to its next logical conclusion after I leave. This bill is about who owns information about the usage of your members. The 49ers have a very advanced, very innovative health plan where they do a lot of coordination of care with their members. And as I listened to their comments about what they were doing, I was really impressed. And I think we should put them in charge of some of the health programs in the state after I heard what they're operating on, because they really have a way of going about their work. They care about their people. They care about the money, but they don't mind if they spend some money to help people get actually better outcomes. And part of the question that arises as they do that, as they guide their patients through a very confusing tangle of specialists and who was the better served and who actually does good work, is about data. And what this bill really is about is whose data is it after all, who can know what. And there are some federal rules about you can't know about that Mary Johnson has some bad disease. But you can know that the people who go to Dr. Smith spend a lot of more money than the people who go to Dr. Johnson. And that's helpful, and that actually, by the way, Dr. Smith costs more and does worse work. And that's what they want to know as they help Dr. Johnson not to be in the network and keep Mr. Dr. Smith. But anyway, so in this bill is actually the fact that it exists created a little bit of a stir. The fact that at a hearing today has even promoted more dialogue. But I hope as you listen to the testimony that you'll be impressed about the strength of not only the 49ers health plan and their commitment to their quality care for their members, but that what they do need some more information to help manage this better, and that's the essence of the bill. And Mr. Chair, with that, I will introduce two testifiers who can give you a lot of content, and I'll excuse myself. So,
great,
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. We appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having this hearing. Thanks for Representative Abler for introducing this bill. My name is Jason George. I'm the legislative and political organizer for the Operating Engineers Local 49. Our union, in conjunction with our employers, administers a self-insured multi-employer health fund, commonly referred to as a Taft-Hartley fund. Our health fund directly pays the health care expenses for 33,000 of our members and their families. We spend over $100 million a year on health care. Our fund has an executive board that is comprised of labor and employee representatives, and they make all the decisions related to health care that is provided to fund participants. Those decisions range from programs we purchase, the networks we rent, prescription drug plans, and all other things that can encompass providing health care to a large population. We're here today to talk about the access to medical claims data. We feel that is an important tool that will help us help our fund manage costs and improve quality. I have two healthcare professionals with me today that will speak directly to the issue of how this data will help us help funds like ours and help self-insured and insured plans. Martha LaFave is our health fund coordinator. She will talk about how medical claims data can help us implement programs that will improve the care our members receive. And Mike Helmer works for Siegel Company and is an actuary for our fund. He'll talk about how transparency related to medical claims data is critical for actuaries that are advising health funds on cost containment. I'll now turn it over to Martha. Before I do, thank you again, Mr. Chair, for having this informational hearing. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Ms. LaFave, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to explain the bill you have before you.
My name is Martha LaFave, and I am the Health Fund Coordinator for Operating Engineers Local 49 Trust Fund. As Jason stated, Local 49 has a self-funded health plan. As a union, our members may change employers during the course of their career, but will remain covered under our health plan throughout their career. Most of our members and their families are covered under our plan from the first day they are initiated into the union until the day they die. Therefore, it is important for us to have our members' utilization and cost data to measure the effect of our programs on the quality of the care they receive, the financial impact in the wellness programs and tools we implement to maintain and improve their health and well-being. Our health plan complies with all aspects of HIPAA regulations, and the information we are seeking will not affect in any way the strict adherence to any and all state and federal laws and regulations. When carriers sell disease management programs and wellness programs to health plans, they use the claims data to determine the patients who would most benefit from each program and focus on those patients in order to get them engaged. They can also analyze this data to determine what programs are needed based on the tests and conditions the patient's claim reflect, and then determine effectiveness. Without access to our data, we are at a disadvantage, and we as a health plan are unable to perform its due diligence in evaluating the effectiveness of its wellness programs. While we have the ability to purchase disease management and wellness programs from independent providers, we are unable to determine the need for specific programs or direct members who need these resources to them. This leads us to guess at what programs to offer our members to assist them in managing their health and wellness. An example of this is one of our programs we currently have is a patient advocacy program that health plan offers to its members and their families. We would use claims data to reach out to the members to assist them when we see that certain tests are being performed that may relate to a diagnosis or condition, and provide them with information so they can select the best quality provider for their condition. Give them additional information regarding their condition and provide them with information on the latest treatments available to them. Catching medical conditions at the earliest stage avoids mistakes made by unqualified and or inexperienced doctors treating our members. Without our data, unless the member is familiar with this program, we are unable to identify and proactively direct our members to our patient advocacy program. They will be on their own when selecting a provider, facing a diagnosis, or making a decision on what treatment option to select. We won't have the data to reach out to our members to inform them of this program. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for giving us this opportunity. I'll turn it over to Mike Helmer, our actuary.
Thank you, Ms. LaFave. Mr. Helmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Mike Helmer. I am a vice president with the Siegel Company and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. Part of my responsibility towards health and welfare funds like the Operating Engineers Local 49 is to assemble financial projections, opine on the reasonableness of renewals from insurance carriers, and provide consultation on decisions with respect to, among other things, whether health funds should be self-insured or fully insured, or if my clients should examine alternative options and opportunities. I am also responsible for recommending wellness programs, as Ms. LaFave discussed, as appropriate based on each health fund's specific demographic and health situations. Clearly, the move towards transparency is a cornerstone of the new Health Reform Act, which includes a requirement that health carriers' loss ratios be at least 85%. This means that $85 out of every $100 of premium paid must go towards actual medical expenses. It will be mine and the fund's fiduciary responsibility to study and report whether or not the health plan is complying with the new law and to what extent. Health funds rely on actuaries and consultants to prepare projections for financial purposes. We need detailed claims information that we can apply certain actuarial assumptions and formulas to, such that health plans can understand whether or not they can afford their current level of benefits, or if financing or plan design changes are necessary to balance their budget. For example, I work with a health fund that was fully insured, and the fund was considering going self-insured. And the fund requested me to perform a risk and a rewards analysis of going self-insured versus remaining fully insured. Essentially, the fund, my client, was directing me to report what, if any, potential savings could be expected and the risks associated with going self-insured. In order to perform this analysis, we requested basic incurred and paid claims analysis from the current insurance carrier and was told we, the insurance carrier, don't have to provide you with this data and we're not going to. Without procuring this data, the client was left to make decisions on gut feel versus actual claims experience. Without acquiring claims experience from the carrier, the fund has no way of knowing whether going self-insured is a reasonable decision or if the proposed renewal from the carrier is fair and competitive.
Mr. Pure.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to add that this bill isn't really about one insurance carrier or another. We are working with the two insurance carriers that we work with to get access to our data right now, but there really is an unlevel playing field. There really is no, right now it's a, people decide whether or not they're going to get it. Some people are getting this data, some people aren't. We really need to level the playing field to make sure that everybody has access and equal access to their information. So this isn't about, I mean, we're here talking today as Operating Engineers Local 49 Fund, but it's not just about us. So I just wanted to make that point too.
Thank you, Mr. George. Representative Davids has a question. I know Ms. Nelson also from Blue Cross wants to testify. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in this committee previously, we had the definition of an actuary. Now, sir, you're actually an actuary?
I'm actually an actuary.
Do you remember what the definition was for an actuary?
Actually, no.
A CPA without a personality. In other words, they're really smart. They're really smart. But, sorry. It went over better last time.
There were no actuaries here last time.
I'm going to hear from the CPAs, too, I suppose. But, sir, I can understand why you feel you need the data here and so forth to make decisions, because you... but my question is this, and maybe this is to Ms. LaFave, is it? Under the new health care proposal, I was just listening to Peter Orzog talk about the new panel that has been set up that will be making decisions instead of the person's doctors. Now, how would that affect what you're looking at here in this bill? Because there'll be a health care panel that will make decisions of employees, bureaucrats, if you will, from Washington, D.C., on who gets treatment, if, and it's not going to be based upon quantity of care, but whether it was quality and actually somewhat, in effect, rationing care in the health care bill that passed. How will that affect what you're trying to do here?
Ms. LaFave?
Thank you. You know, I can't definitely speak to the health care bill on that point, but I know that our health plan is working with a program that directs our members, if they choose to certain providers based on data that we gather on these providers. And we'll continue moving forward as a self-funded plan doing that. So as it relates to the health care reform bill, I don't know if that would be working with people that are covered under a public option or another option, but as far as the self-insured plans, we still have to monitor and maintain our own health plan and make sure that the money's being spent properly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. LaFave, would your self-funded programs be under the direction of that health care panel, or would you still be able to make your own decisions separately and continue somewhat in the way that you're operating now?
The extension, no, Rep. Ms. LaFave.
I'm not sure the answer to that. I hope that we can continue to operate as we have been.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I do like actuaries.
Oh, we too. Representative Sanders, if it's all right with you, I just want to make sure we get the testimony from Ms. Nelson in case there's questions to that. So, Ms. Nelson, can you come on down? Y'all don't have to all leave. She's relatively friendly. She may not like the bill. Ms. Nelson, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and I am not an actuary. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I'll be very brief. We feel this legislation is not necessary. We feel that it is customer service and that we will work with any of our clients or plans to provide them the data that they need under current regulations. For certain self-funded plans, we do provide a significant amount of data, including a Xywav reporting tool where they can access the data from their office and drill down on the claims data. We provide that on a monthly basis. We also provide an insights report, which provides specific utilization. A lot of these reports that they have mentioned specifically and Representative Abler mentioned specifically, because we do want them to know what their claims data is, what their utilization is, and how they can manage their plan more appropriately. So we feel that this is more of a customer service and really not needed legislation. It's more the self-funded groups working with the specific health plans, no matter who they may be. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Are there any questions for Ms. Nelson? Otherwise, I want to go back to Representative Sanders because he was nice enough to allow me to refer to you. Ms. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I don't necessarily know who this question is for. Representative Abler looks like he's already checked out, perhaps. But my thoughts are immediately from reading this is if we're turning over comprehensive medical claims data, and I think I'm with you on the goal here of transparency and trying to work with the insurers to bring down costs. I think that's an absolutely noble goal. The question I have is if we're turning over participant-specific medical claims information or claims submitted for payment, including diagnostic codes, what type of protection is there for the people that actually needed these services? In other words, you know, if you only have one person in your company that is fighting breast cancer or, you know, someone that's being tested for something they may not want their employer to know about, what types of protections are there for this data as well as really my thought is just even in the protection of their jobs?
Who wants to take that? Ms. LeFevre.
Answer that. We are actually a health plan. We're not an employer. We don't represent an employer. We're a combination of a group of trustees that run this health plan, and that's what a self-funded plan is. So we have the rights under HIPAA. We are part of the group that captures this data, so we would not be in violation of getting any of this information.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern is that it looks like in this bill that any employer, as you were saying, this wasn't just we heard testimony, this wasn't just about your particular situation or local 49s or either of those health insurance providers. So my concern is if we are doing this on a broad playing field here, which looks like that's what we're doing, that's where my concern really goes. So I just want to make sure that at least going forward that we really start having a conversation about protecting the privacy of those people because it's very specific here. In turning over the actual claims that were submitted for payment, including diagnostic codes and some of the pricing claims. So, you know, I don't know if there's any better answers, but if we're doing this on a broad playing field, broad scope, I think that's something we really need to be careful of.
My guess is that that's probably a concern shared across both sides of the table. Mr. Helmer, you want to add something on that point?
Yeah, this is for health plan operations. This isn't, there's a big distinction there. And I believe it's actually legal right now for a fund coordinator to, with respect to health plan operations, to access that data.
Representative Sanders?
One quick follow-up to that. Just going off what the bill says right here, line 1.19, we are turning this over to the employers as well. So this goes beyond just the health plan. So I just want to make sure for the record as we're moving forward, that's the concern, that if we're doing this across the board for all employers, I think we have some big concerns that need to be addressed.
And that's a good catch. Representative Anderson, are you the one that needed the dolly to bring in your Coke, by the way? That thing? My God, you could swim in that.
Yes. Well, I always try to drink an equal amount of water during the day, too, so try and offset the caffeine intake. That's why I have a little jitters in the morning. But Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not to beat a dead horse on this issue, but I share the concerns that Representative Sanders has. The bill as it is drafted does turn over this information to the employer. And my concern is what if you are planning to get pregnant, you go into the doctor, you're asking for your prenatal vitamins, your employer is going to have that information. And though we'd like to think that that wouldn't be held against you as an employee, hopefully that's never the case, but if it were, you know, I think we're going down a slippery slope that I think will cause more problems than it will solve. So that's just some of the concerns that I have. I understand that your intent was that it would just go to the plan coordinator, but as the bill is written, it does go directly to the employer. So
thank you. And I don't know that we're necessarily looking for a response. The point of an informational hearing was to try to tee the issue up, because I anticipate between the federal health issues that will end up many parts of them in front of our committee, in addition to issues like this, that we're going to have a number of these sorts of items in coming years, whether I'm chair or somebody else is chair. So it's a good opportunity to kind of give a bit of the flavor. Representative Mansell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, since this is an informational hearing, let me take a shot at providing you with a little information about how it is that Taft-Hartley multi-employer labor unions make decisions. First of all, first point is all of the decisions are made by the members. Hypothetically, in the case of collective bargaining negotiations, the pool of employers and the labor organization reach an agreement. And most often, it would call for X amount of dollars, or in some cases, cents, per hour. And the members themselves decide how to allocate those dollars. That's one of the Taft-Hartley principles. And so that every employer covered by the collective bargaining agreement and signatory to the agreement would be bound to allocation decisions made by the members. And the members would decide to put X amount of the raise, if there is one, on the check, X amount into the pension, and X amount into health and welfare. Now, it just seems to me that in order for the members to make informed decisions, that they should have this information. They should have this information available to them. So as you move forward, Mr. Chair, and on the bill, I hope you keep that in mind.
Thank you, Representative Anseltz. Representative Davids, you've got one final word, and then we're going to move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question for Mr. Pender on line 1.7. It talks about health plan companies, or they mentioned self-funded. Are these ERISA plans, or are these outside of ERISA, or it says health plan companies? And so my question would be, where would this be administered by, or who would this be administered by, Department of Commerce or Department of Health? And whichever one it is, do they have a position on the bill?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the reference to health plan companies in line 1.7, that's a defined term in our statutes, and it basically includes HMOs, insurance companies, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and so on, when they're acting as an insurer and bearing insurance risk. So it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be describing them in a role with a self-funded plan that would be exempt under ERISA. The health plan companies are entities that we can regulate, so it's not unusual to see them mentioned in a bill that the legislature is dealing with. It does sound like here that the specific health plans involved are primarily self-insured health plans.
Mr. Pender, if I could just briefly interrupt. We have a bunch of pages that before they take off, I wanted to thank them for joining us here in the Commerce Committee.
One in particular, this fellow that just waved in the blue, is from God's country in Invergrove Heights. So thank you very much for your service this week. He also lives in my basement eating my pizza and drinking my pop. So thank you all for coming down. I think he gave me one instruction this week, which was to not embarrass him. So I've already defied that, that instruction. Mr. Pender, I apologize for interrupting, though. That give enough of an answer?
Well, I guess...
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we should ask him some questions about your basement before he gets
away. See you, Tom. Take care, buddy.
I guess, Mr. Chair and Mr. Pender, would these plans be regulated by the Department of Commerce or the Department of Health?
Mr. Pender.
Or both.
Or by you personally.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, if we're talking about insured plans here, which I think we're primarily not, we're talking about self-insured plans. But if it's insured plans, if it's provided by an HMO, it's the Department of Health, and if it's a for-profit insurance company or Blue Cross, it would be the Department of Commerce, except that Blue Cross has an HMO subsidiary, which would be regulated by the Department of Health. But I think here I think this bill is mostly talking about self-funded plans, either self-funded by an employer or a self-funded by a union or group of unions, a multi-employer plan, and those are plans that the state can't regulate.
Thank you,
Mr. Federal
Chairman.
Law.
Thank you. Thank you to the committee members for your attention, and thank you very much for bringing this bill in front of us. We'll give our thanks to Representative Abler when I run into him on the floor later. But I do anticipate that this and other issues will be and are appropriately teed up before this committee for further discussion next session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, and thank you for your understanding to those that came to see the first bill on the calendar. It's House File 3623. Mr. Browson and Mr. Thompson, if you could come on down to the table. While we're waiting for that, we've got two sets of minutes from the March 18th and April 6th meeting. Representative Lilly moves approval of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. This bill is actually my bill. It came relatively late in the session, brought a little bit of consternation in response from some folks in the banking industry. So I thought it wise to do with this bill what we just did with the last one, which is give an opportunity for members to kind of get their heads around it a little bit, get some testimony before the committee, and see where it goes from here. The general topic, and these folks are much more articulate relative to it than I am, but it's when you use a debit card or credit card, there's fees that are charged by the Visas and the MasterCards and so forth. And those fees, in the opinion of some of the retailers, have gotten pretty expensive, such that I think now if you, like, buy a 50-cent pack of gum or a cup of coffee or something, sometimes those fees are so darn expensive that it's hard to make a profit. And this is a specific issue relative to those fees, but I thought it would be a nice opportunity to hear about that. And then we've got some folks from the banking and credit union type industries that will share their thoughts with us as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Who wants to go first?
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Thompson. With me today is Ted Browson, who is a member of the Minnesota Service Station Association and a gasoline convenience store retailer. And to Ted's right is Lance Klatt, the executive director of the Minnesota Service Station Association. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Service Station Association, which is an association of gasoline dealers and retailers in the state of Minnesota. We're here on the informational meeting on House File 3623, and I want to start out by talking about what we're here about. If most of us carry in our wallets or purses two different kinds of cards. One's a credit card, the other one's a debit card. Credit card, you know how that works. They put it on an account and charge you interest if you don't pay it off. The debit card is what you use at your ATM, that you can take money out of the ATM, but you can also use it to pay for gas or groceries or whatever, and the money comes out of your bank account. And specifically what we're talking about in this bill are debit card types, because there's two types. In Minnesota, we have what's known as signature debit. That is, instead of entering a PIN number, you sign, if the retailer requires you to sign, in order to use the card. That's why when you go into many retail establishments and there's a PIN pad there and they say select credit or debit, even though you're using a debit card, if you don't push the credit button, it won't work. You can't enter a PIN number because we do not have a PIN-based debit system in Minnesota. In fact, a lot of them have little signs on those PIN pads that say don't push debit because you'll have to start all over with the transaction. There is a cost to processing credit cards and debit cards that costs American consumers tens of billions of dollars a year. For individual retailers, it can cost them tens of thousands of dollars or more per year. It's a hidden cost. Consumers are unaware of it, but everyone pays. And what do I mean by that? Even if you pay cash, you're paying for these transaction fees because the agreements from the credit card and debit card companies do not allow you to charge extra for credit or debit, so the cost gets passed on to all consumers, even if you're paying cash. We pay among the highest costs in the world for our credit and debit charges. Part of them is the interchange rate. Part of it is the credit card or debit card processing fees. Our goal in this bill is to find a solution that lowers costs for retailers and consumers and increases security. But the key to that is doing it right. And that means having a PIN-based debit system that genuinely lowers costs. Now, PIN-based debit is not some exotic card. You have it in Iowa, you have it in Wisconsin, for example. You have it in most of the country. Let me tell you the difference that you find between Minnesota signature debit and other PIN-based debit in the gasoline industry. And these charges that are set by the credit card companies and the banks vary by industry. They vary by transaction amount. But I'm just going to take a $25 debit card transaction in Minnesota would cost you 38.7 cents to process. Under the Alaska one, it would be 27.8 cents. It would be 3 cents less in Iowa than it would be in Minnesota. These savings result in millions of extra dollars that retailers and ultimately consumers pay. We know that a major retailer might pay over $10 to process a large ticket item in Minnesota on a debit card, where in Wisconsin that charge would be capped at 75 cents. And like I said, these costs are passed on to consumers, even if you pay cash, because of the agreements that prohibit you from charging more for debit or credit. We believe there's greater security in debit cards, that when cards are stolen or fraudulent, there are chargebacks that go back to the retailer. But if you steal or find a PIN-based debit card, it's much more difficult to know the PIN number, and therefore it improves security, would reduce chargebacks, and therefore reduce costs to consumers and retailers. Overdrafts are different. Under a PIN-based system, you have real-time debit card transactions coming out of your bank account. Under signature debit, it is not real-time, and therefore the result is that consumers who think that the transaction went through, they must have had enough money in the account, may be surprised to find that they have overdraft charges from their bank. All retailers agree that we have a serious problem in the magnitude of the charges that are paid for processing credit and debit cards. The costs are simply too high. We have today a representative from the gasoline industry, Ted Brousen. We have representatives from SuperValu and the grocery industry that are here, and I think they have some handouts. This issue became very apparent to gasoline dealers because they were being required by their suppliers to install, under PCI compliance, PIN pads, which cost thousands of dollars of these PCI upgrades, and they can't even use them to process debit cards. Our goal in this legislation is dialogue between the retailers, consumers, banks, and the credit card industry to find the best solution for Minnesota. Until now, retailers and consumers have not had a place at the table to be able to negotiate and discuss these issues with the banks and with the credit card companies. And we're asking this committee, as part of this process, to encourage the parties to meet and bring a proposal to the legislature next year that can meet the needs of everyone who are stakeholder. I'll turn it over to Ted Browson unless there's any questions from the chair or the members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Browson, welcome
Mr.
to the
chair,
committee.
The only thing thank you.
If I can, we've got about half an hour scheduled for each of these three bills. So we've got roughly 15 minutes in favor, 15 minutes from folks that may have concerns or opposition to it. Gives you about 5 minutes yet.
Super. I'll go fast.
So, Mr. Browson.
Last year, I owned one little Shell station in beautiful downtown Arden Hills. Been there since 69. I'm a second-generation dealer. Third generation is working there as we speak. But our credit card fees just in that site last year were $89,112 in one little gas station. My payment to the bank, my property taxes were $96,000. So you know where these fees rank in the cost of us doing business. I'm just going to kind of go off and just one of the things that concerns on the credit card fees, what a lot of people don't understand, and it kind of really, that Invergrove Heights restaurant, you know, we have to insure ourselves with liability and stuff, but there's credit cards stolen and that kind of stuff. So we start looking really into our system of our stolen credit cards and stuff, and I'll get back to why I'm concerned, but one is to protect our customers. I mean, that's our number one goal, liability-wise, we've got to protect our customers. The other side of that is what people don't understand is when we take a stolen credit card, I don't care if it's at the pump or if our 16-year-old cashier takes it and doesn't check the ID, we pay for that. Not only do we pay for that transaction, they also charge us another $25. Goes on top of that. So the PIN base would give us so much more security for our customers and obviously for us. So we're very concerned about that. Obviously, we all know that we're paying for all the stolen credit cards. We're all paying for that. And then we get back to what Randy said a little bit, is the upgrade of these cash registers. Now, Visa and MasterCard came back to us independent dealers and said, well, now your cash registers aren't going to work anymore. So we've got to buy all new cash registers. Everybody in the state of Minnesota, or 90%, we have to spend another $25,000 to upgrade to their system, which obviously doesn't bring us any revenue. It's just an expense. Now, that site there, profit was about $35,000 last year we made on that site. So you can see where the credit card companies are making so much more, yet they're requiring us to spend another $25,000 to upgrade to their system. It gets expensive. It's hard to do business.
Thank you, Mr. Browser.
Yeah. Thank you.
Are we, Ms. Platt, do you have anything, or are you just sort of phone a friend? And
no, that's okay. Why I'm up here.
All right. And we do have Representative Hoppe's on the list. If it's all right with you, Representative Hoppe, I think what I'll do is just take all of the testimony, and then we'll circle back and see what questions members have. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Joe Witt from the Minnesota Bankers Association, Lynn Cota from the North Memorial Federal Credit Union. Mr. Witt, welcome back.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members. Joe Witt from the Minnesota Bankers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Minnesota Bankers Association represents 95% of the banks operating in Minnesota, from the largest banks on down to the smallest. Every single bank cares very much about the issues that are covered in this bill. It's not just an issue for large banks. It is an issue for every single bank in the state. This is an informational hearing, I understand, and I was told to talk to the bill, so that's what I'm going to do here today, to the bill as introduced. The subject matter is very complex, as you've heard here today from the proponents of the bill. There's lots of different players that are operating in this field in order to make these transactions happen. It is a very complex global system that allows these cards to be used. It works, and it works very well. I understand that that the retailers and that the service stations want to take a look at some pieces of how it's working, but you really do have to take the pieces that they're talking about in the context of the bigger system that is working. There are at least four interested groups that we've heard about here today. First is consumers. Consumers want convenience. They want a choice in how they can pay for their products and services. Retailers, we've heard from, they want to make their customers happy. Heard today that they also want to save money on their transactions that they're doing, but they also want to make sure that their transactions are secure. Card issuers, banks and credit unions that are issuing the plastic, they want to make sure that their customers are happy. They want to ensure that transactions are secure. They want to prevent fraud, and they want to reduce liability. The primary party that's liable for fraud on these cards is the issuing banks and credit unions. It's the issuers. They are the primarily liable, so that's why they want to have secure transactions. We also heard about the systems. You have your Visa, your MasterCard, Shazam, and other payments stream controllers. They want secure transactions, and they want to get paid for the work that's gone into setting up these complex systems and for maintaining the systems. All different interests come together to make sure the payment system works. And again, the payment system does work. Credit and debit cards are responsible for $3 trillion of transactions a year. Electronic cards are accepted at 24 million locations worldwide. There are more than 6,000 U.S. card issuers that would have an interest in a bill like this. There are currently about 450 million debit cards in the U.S., and by the way, consumers love them. There are massive processing systems with the capability to handle 10,000 transactions per second. Those systems were created in order to handle that stuff. And again, it's a very complex system. A lot goes into creating that system. A lot goes into maintaining it. A lot goes into making sure that the systems work. And again, we've got to make sure that we look at this type of a bill in the context of that greater global system. To the bill, there's two parts to it, and I'll start with actually the second part, which is delaying the PCI standards. Minnesota has been a leader in protecting people's privacy. Before anybody cared about the privacy issue, this legislature was working to ensure that we are protecting our citizens. The PCI standards are in place for a very good reason. We've seen a lot of data breaches. We've seen the damage that can happen from it. A lot of those data breaches were at retailers, and the retailers recognize that they need to step up their compliance with their information security. The banks have also been doing this. As you all know, there are very strict state and federal laws that require us to maintain privacy, and we've been adhering to those standards as well. Identity theft is a horrible crime, whether it's an individual that gets their stuff stolen or a whole batch of identities that get stolen. They cost the banks millions to reissue their cards. It costs the retailers, it costs everybody. So that's why these PCI standards are in place. I think it's a horrible message that the state legislature would send that in our statutes we would say that we don't want to comply with these PCI standards. Again, Minnesota was a leader in making sure that we have good privacy standards. I would hate to see in our statutes that we're not adopting these types of standards. And as you look at it, I would think that the gas stations would be especially concerned about not being compliant at their machines. A lot of the gas stations that stay open for business all night, but they don't have employees there. You would think that they would be a logical target for people that would want to steal data on those machines. So I would think that they would really see the value of making sure that they had good standards in place. Then to the first part of the bill, which is about PIN-based debit versus the signature-based debit. Again, this is the part that gets very complex with respect to the types of systems that are out there and the types of capabilities on the card. Remember that this is a worldwide system. There are lots of different issuers that issue cards with different capabilities. Because there are different capabilities for the cards, it would have a different impact on different types of businesses. PIN-based debit works better in certain circumstances, but the signature-based ones work better in others. If you look at the travel industry, for example, if you go get a rental car on your debit card and they put a hold on your account and then later have a different charge, that works very well with signature-based cards but doesn't work with PIN-based cards. So hotel charges and others like that, where you might have an initial hold on your account with a later settle up, just doesn't work very well with the PIN-based system. The other question that I'd have is if we went to this PIN-based system and you wanted to use a PIN at like a restaurant where you give your card to somebody and they swipe it somewhere else, would you then give your PIN to the waiter that's taking your card away? I'm not sure that we would really want that situation where we would give them the card and the PIN number. It seems to me like that would be some additional risks. Also, I'm not sure the impact that this type of state law would have on all the card issuers around the country, whether you could require national banks, whether you could require federal thrifts and federal credit unions to comply with this state law. And I know that, again, we're supposed to be speaking to the bill, but the retailers are talking a lot about the costs of these transactions, and it seems like they're not focusing much on the benefits that they get from these transactions. Remember, they have the choice of what type of payment method they're going to take. It used to be that everybody took checks. Now nobody takes checks. We are moving in a direction of these electronic cards. But the retailers do get benefit from it. Again, if you're a gas station that can stay open at night beyond the hours that you have people working there, they're getting a benefit from those electronic transactions. They also don't have to worry about taking those checks if they're more risky, or stolen checks, or any of those things. I guess from our standpoint, again, we just wanted to remind you that this is a very complex global system that we're talking about, and make sure you take that into account if you're looking at state law changes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lynn Cothey, and I'm the President CEO of North Memorial Federal Credit Union in Robbinsdale, and the new Maple Grove Hospital also serves those people. We serve 4,500 members who are employees and family members of the medical center. We strive to meet the financial needs of a very diverse economic group of people, from North Minneapolis out to the suburbs. And I'm here to just express my concern with HF 3623, the debit PIN-based transaction. Under this proposed legislation, the only type of debit permitted would be a PIN-based and not a signature-based. And I'd like to just address a little bit how this would affect my members and my credit union. I'm concerned that the bill would harm our members by limiting where they could use their debit card. In the online payment, pay at the pump, reservations by credit card only we live in, our members could not use their debit cards for these transactions, ones we take for granted, such as restaurants, reservations, and online purchases. Not to mention that our members try to manage their budget and control their spending by a preloaded card, which does not require a PIN to make a purchase. Without signature-based debit transactions, my members who do not qualify for a credit card, and a lot of people don't, they would be forced to use other payment options, such as carrying cash. In addition to the loss of consumer convenience to use their debit card, it would also be a substantial financial burden to my credit union to reissue every debit card. At North Memorial, we have 1,450 debit cards, and to replace them would cost about $2.27 per card, or a total of $3,178, and that's for a smaller credit union. Not to mention the staff time that it would take to replace these cards at approximately $13.50 an hour. As a not-for-profit financial institution, this is our members' money that we would be taking to comply with this law. As you may know, interchange fee income would not cover the loss of income for reissuing these cards, nor does current interchange fee income get added as a simple profit stream for the credit union. Our fee income helps to offset the actual cost of offering this debit card program to our members. In 2009, our cost to First Data, which is our processor, was over $36,000. This does not cover any personal time to administer the card program in-house or to cover any debit card losses. The credit union accepts the risk of losses when we issue the cards. The credit union accepts the risk of losses when we issue debit cards, while the retailer is guaranteed payment from the debit and credit transaction. We have already had several losses in 2010. Our own administrative time for our card program is an average of 10 hours per week. This doesn't include posting or anything like that, but just administration of ordering cards, blocking cards, contacting members if we feel there's been fraud. And here again, that's about 520 hours a year at over $13.50 an hour. Merchants do not have to accept debit cards as a form of payment. When they do, they are guaranteed payment. They don't have a loss if the fraud card is fraudulent or if it's stolen. As long as they get an authorization, they get paid. The financial institution that issued the card bears the loss. Retailers could choose not to accept debit or credit cards. This is their choice. I am very concerned that this bill would exempt merchants from following the rules outlined in the PCI standards to safeguard consumer information. Not by following PCI standards, this would lead to data breaches, which could put consumers at risk of experiencing transactional and identity theft fraud. The financial institution losses would increase while the merchant is exempt. So what are PCI standards? And I think we talked about that, but they are the standards that all merchants accepting credit and debit cards are required to follow. The payment card industry standards was developed in 2004 by the credit card industry, including Visa, MasterCard, Discover Card, and American Express, to create an industry-wide standard to guard debit and credit data. All merchants processing, transmitting, or storing credit card data are required to comply with the new payment card industry data security standard by June 30th of 2005. What will happen if merchants are not required to comply with PCI standards? I am concerned that this will lead to the member's account being breached. There have been several high-profile breaches in the past several years that have occurred because merchants were not following current PCI standards. The compromise of our members' financial information provides not only liability for my credit union, but also threats to real-life issues for my members. As a small credit union, I am very concerned about this issue. In the end, this bill will not only restrict the ability of my members in using their debit card, but could possibly put Minnesota consumers in unnecessary risk of fraud by mandating PIN and based transactions only. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Cauley. And I know we had Representative Hoppe was on the list, or maybe others. Representative Hoppe had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess it was when Mr. Thompson was up there, but it could go to anybody. And I have a list of questions. In the interest of time, I'll just make a couple of quick comments. I'm sympathetic to what, you know, the aim of the bill is, and I think that I'm glad we're having an informational hearing, and this needs more exploring, I think, on both sides. I'm not sure that this bill does what you want it to do, and I think when we look at the part on the back, Subdivision 4, the moratorium on PCI compliance, if this bill were going to go forward, I would at least try to put an amendment on there that would let consumers know that a station that wasn't going to be PCI compliant wasn't PCI compliant. I think at the least we should be looking at protecting all of our consumers, and we have all of us, whether it's a credit card or a debit card, maybe we're a little naive, but I think we have the expectation that when we use that card to purchase goods or services, that our personal information is going to be protected. And I think the idea that we would opt out anybody out of PCI is not something we should be continuing to explore. And I have more questions. I'm glad we're working on this, and I'm confident it will be worked on in the interim and going forward. But for right now, I think it needs a little bit more work and thought, and I know this is the first step. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Actually, since the bill was introduced, we've been approached and contacted and emailed by all sorts of folks well beyond just the scope of the bill, and many raising the difference between our rates here in Iowa and Alaska and others, and talking about the protections that so it clearly was the issue blossomed into much more than the bill anticipated. And that's why we're having the informational hearing and why we'll continue to give it further time. Representative Davney had a question or concern or comment?
A couple of quick comments, Mr. Chair. I'm sympathetic as well to the retailers. I'm not sure, however, how the new Federal Card Act and the requirement now that financial institutions have you opt in to overdraft protection interacts with the difference between a signature and a PIN debit card transaction. So that's something, if the bill moves forward, that I think we'd need to clarify. I do, however, feel an obligation to put a little finer point on some of the concerns that particularly Mr. Witt raised, but also Representative Hoppe, on what it means to give a moratorium to PCI compliance. And I'd remind members that now the second largest identity theft in the nation's history happened here in the East Metro. and it was because a retailer wasn't being PCI compliant, and 44 million people had their identities stolen. And not being PCI compliant means that the retailer doesn't have to have a firewall in their computer system to protect your data. They don't have any obligation to protect your stored data. They don't have to encrypt the information if they transmit it over a public network, and that's exactly what was going on in the East Metro. They don't have to keep their antivirus software updated. They don't have to have secure systems at all. They don't have to restrict access to your personal information on to a need-to-know basis. So the 16-year-old in his downtime can go, you know, let his fingers do the walking through your private data if he wants. The beggar at the grocery store on his break can go through your private data because there's no obligation under Subdivision 4 that they maintain PCI compliance. They don't have to restrict physical access. There's just a number of issues of cardholder privacy here that we would be saying retailers would be held harmless from. And I would actually question, and I don't know, but if we provide this moratorium, do Visa and MasterCard and everyone else say, you're not complying with our stuff, you can't accept our cards? And, you know, there's an argument for a cash-based economy, but I'm not sure I want to have it every day because I'm mandated by the state legislature to do so.
Barter economy.
We could go there, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Sanders, you get the final word, and then we're going to move on to our final final bill for today.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I share those similar concerns, and I'll submit that if the PCI standards, if we have a place of moratorium, we will see a dramatic rise in the cost of the processing fees because the banks, large and small, the credit card or debit card issuers are going to want to protect themselves from the fraud or potential instances of fraud that Representative Dabney just listed. So I don't think that this necessarily gets exactly where we want to go, but I think it's a good start. And I think we'll also have to address how do we do the simple things like restaurants or the 24-hour service pay at the pump. I mean, a lot of questions left to be answered, but thank you for bringing the conversation forward. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Thank you to everybody that testified. You did, in a half an hour, you took a very complicated topic and I think boiled it down to one that even those of us with a third-grade education can at least start to get our heads around. It's one that I anticipate over the summer and fall and into next year there will be considerably more attention given to. So thank you all very much for coming to testify today. The final topic, and if Lance Hill, Daniel Pulliam, and Courtney Storysved could come down to get us underway, it's the access to event tickets in the primary and secondary market. I'll just kind of kick it off. Access to tickets, some folks kind of kid around about. Is Miley Cyrus bill or whatever, the Bruce Springsteen tickets and all that. It's become a multi-billion dollar industry. Minnesota laws have changed dramatically just over the last few years. We have attorneys general across the country pursuing lawsuits and fines and so forth against people that aren't doing it in the right fashion. When I introduced a bill earlier this year that simply talked of disclosure of, all right, how many tickets, if you're a forum, how many tickets are you actually making available to the public, and how many are you holding back for other purposes? That created quite a stir, and I give a great deal of credit to the folks in that industry for raising a number of concerns about it. I'm trying to wrap my head around those concerns, and I appreciate their bringing them forward. The idea that the issue is just going to quietly go away, I don't think is going to happen either. My guess is that we're probably going to continue to see more and more instances of tickets being at issue and access to tickets being at issue. And therefore, I just invited both sides to come and visit with us a little bit today as a committee. And not because I necessarily expect bills or amendments to happen this year, but because whether it's my bill or somebody else's or some other instances that give rise to legislation, it's probably one that this committee has some awareness of since we seem to be the home of issues that arise relative to the issue. With that, who wants to kick it off?
I'll start things off. Right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee and invited guests, my name is Lance Lancio. I'm Director of Legal Affairs for StubHub, a wholly owned subsidiary of eBay, Inc. As you may know, eBay is the world's largest marketplace with over 89 million users worldwide who buy and sell almost everything from automobiles to video games and everything in between, including live event tickets. Adding to its legacy of improving inefficient markets, eBay acquired StubHub about 3 years ago and has grown the company into the largest online marketplace for tickets, offering best-in-class consumer protections, including a fan protect guarantee that ensures fans will get into an event or receive 100% of their money back. At eBay and StubHub, we fundamentally believe that open, transparent markets free of artificial restraints are the best way to deliver low prices and value to consumers. Whether consumers are unable to obtain tickets to a Taylor Swift concert because 85% of the tickets are held back for industry insiders, or whether they have the opportunity to buy a $5 NBA ticket on game day, consumers depend on open, transparent ticket marketplaces to obtain tickets at market prices or to sell tickets they cannot use. So we believe that open transferability is critical to successful marketplaces. There's one absolutely critical component for efficient markets to remain efficient and to truly benefit consumers: open transferability. Up until recently, fans have relied on tickets being similar to anything else they might purchase. If they can't use them, they can sell them or give them away however they choose. Until 2008, tickets were issued primarily in one of two forms, either in paper stock or electronically, and that was typically in a PDF format. Both types of tickets are easily transferable, whether via mail or email services, and whether or not the original purchaser gives them away or sells them online. In the past year or so, however, primary ticketing companies have been rolling out services that would either outright prohibit the free transferability of tickets, or even more insidious, force consumers to use their services to resell their tickets. The underlying technology that primary ticketing companies are using to block open transferability is called paperless ticketing. While eBay and StubHub continuously create and embrace new technologies, we do not support technologies when they're used to block consumers from using competing marketplaces and used to artificially raise prices to consumers. So how does a closed paperless ticket exchange work? Suppose you purchase a ticket to the upcoming John Mayer tour and cannot use the ticket. According to Ticketmaster's website, you must use Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange website. You must use their paperless ticket exchange to resell the ticket. And more important, you cannot sell the ticket below face value. So this is similar to what Ticketmaster has enabled for the paperless ticket exchange for Penn State and other customers in the past several months. So if you live in a market where John Mayer isn't very popular and you can no longer use a John Mayer ticket, you might be happy to get $20 for that ticket you may have paid $49.50 for, or more, given the extra fees involved. However, because the ticket exchange rules that prohibit sales below face value, you're out of luck. You won't be able to use the service. Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange not only won't let you sell your ticket at market price, but it also prevents you from giving that ticket away or selling it to a colleague or on eBay, because paperless tickets are otherwise non-transferable. So what do you have to believe to keep marketplaces open? We think you have to believe three things to keep markets open and to require open transferability. First, consumers have legitimate reasons to resell tickets. Second, that interoperability won't harm consumers. And third, that competition will lead to innovation and better services at lower prices. So with respect to the need to sell tickets, there's a real need for people to resell tickets, including season ticket holders who can't possibly attend all 81 home Major League Baseball games, or those who need to resell tickets to defray the high costs of tickets. There are fans for whom illness or financial reasons prevent them from using concert tickets, which are often sold weeks or months in advance of a show, or fans who simply have a change of plans. We've seen industry figures indicating that upwards of 30% of people cannot attend shows for which they've purchased tickets. The second point is that interoperability won't harm consumers. Consumer protections will continue to thrive even if you require interoperability. StubHub has already successfully integrated with Ticketmaster and other primary ticketing companies with respect to the delivery of electronic tickets. There's no reason why primary ticketing companies cannot create secure APIs that enable fans to use competing marketplaces for the resale and transfer of paperless ticket event tickets as well, all while preserving the benefits of technology and consumers' rights. And then finally, competition fosters innovation and leads to better services at lower prices. If consumers are forced to use a primary ticketing company's secondary marketplace, they'll be subjected to a lower quality of service, arbitrary price floors, and potentially higher fees for these same resale services. As we've seen with the paperless ticket exchange for John Mayer, the consumer-unfriendly policies may even make it impossible for fans to resell the tickets, a potentially huge cost to fans. So is there anything else when you think about this issue that you buy that requires resale through the primary distributor? Imagine if you bought a Ford Focus from your local Ford dealership and were forced to resell that car through the same dealership at a price that the dealership sets to ensure that you didn't cannibalize any new car sales. That's exactly what primary ticketing companies are now trying to do with their closed paperless ticket exchanges. So eBay advocates transparency and open markets. eBay and StubHub call for changes that ensure that fans understand when and how many tickets are available so that market forces make sense to them. An open and transparent primary tickets market would allow consumers to make educated decisions about when to purchase tickets and for how much. Consumers wouldn't be shocked when tickets sell out in minutes if they understood that only a small fraction of tickets were available to the general public. In addition, primary ticketing companies should be restricted from imposing technological barriers such as closed paperless ticket exchanges that force consumers to use their marketplace services only. So on behalf of the over 875,000 eBay and StubHub users located in Minnesota, I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lancio.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Daniel Polian. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Ticket Network. We're actually a competitor in the market space with StubHub. We have approximately 6.6 million tickets posted online at any given time with a total dollar value of roughly about $1.2 billion and growing year by year. First, I want to thank Chairman Atkins for his leadership both this year and last year on several issues related to ticketing and the ticketing industry in particular. And wanted to offer some comments on consumer access to event tickets in the primary and secondary ticketing markets. Specifically, I'd like to talk about transparency in the ticketing market as it relates to how tickets are initially distributed to consumers in the market space. Consumers win when they base their ticket buying decisions on information that is readily available regarding the events that they choose to attend. Creating this transparency in the primary ticketing market helps set consumer expectations and gives them important information about the likelihood of obtaining tickets to popular and or highly sought after events that come into various markets in Minnesota. Many consumers are unaware that ticket availability for events is limited by issues related to even stage design, where the stage is set up in the auditorium and how many seats that might consume depending upon the type of stage design that's brought in by different artists. And also includes ticket holdbacks for fan clubs, pre-sales, rewards programs through companies like American Express, MasterCard, and other issues like that. Also radio station giveaways and even the artist and the artist promotion and management teams when they come in for these concerts. One thing I want to be clear about, as Lance referred to, with 81 home games for Major League Baseball and most of the professional sports and collegiate sporting events that are held in Minnesota, tickets are obtained in a vast array of different ways. There are major differences between the way that a one-time concert comes into a venue and distributes tickets for that one single event versus how tickets are distributed for a whole season of events for a particular sports team. The transparency portion that we're talking about today may not necessarily wholly apply to the way that sporting tickets are distributed. We find that most of the issues that arise with related to transparency arise out of the concert of business itself. So in addition to the number of tickets that are withheld, the question always comes up is, why do concerts sell out so fast? A lot of it has to do with population density, depending upon where the venue is and how many people would like to go to that event. And those issues raise or lower certain consumer expectations about how they might obtain tickets and where they can get them. In the materials that we've handed out, I'll point to a statement from Barry Diller, the chairman of Ticketmaster, that he gave last year to the USA Today during their CEO forum. He talks about the ticketing industry and the ticketing business being the essence of non-transparency, and that there are reasons why that that is so in the industry. The interesting thing about that is he goes on to say that he thinks somewhere in the country, sooner or later, legislation is going to be brought about that will force transparency in the market. We couldn't agree more with his statement, and we do believe that that transparency in this marketplace will provide better access to information for consumers as they decide to buy tickets. I want to point out, you had several concerts here where there were instantaneous or almost instantaneous sellouts. We have some examples of ticket distributions that we've provided in your materials. The first one is a concert, Hannah Montana concert, that was done in Missouri in 2007. When the tickets went on sale to the general public at 10 a.m. in the morning on the day of the on sale, only roughly 37% of those tickets were released for the entire venue. So when tickets sell out in a matter of minutes, or sometimes even we've seen lately quite literally seconds where tickets are all gone for the distribution, it's not sometimes about every ticket being sold. It's about how many tickets are being made available at that particular time. The next one is Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen released 73% of his tickets, which is actually a high number and a watermark that we see as encouraging. Bruce Springsteen tends to be a little more giving in terms of how many tickets are initially distributed during that distribution. The two other examples that I'll point out to you are a Taylor Swift concert that was held in September of 2009, and also another concert that was held in October of 2009 for Keith Urban. In one example for Taylor Swift, the general on sale date at 10 a.m. in the morning, when people went to buy tickets for that general on sale and it sold out in minutes, they released 1,591 tickets to that event. Roughly 11% of all the tickets that were released for that general on sale, of everything that was available in the concert venue, out of over 14,000 tickets. So we believe that that information is crucial, that consumers have if they have access to that information, that they will be able to decide how best, where, when to obtain tickets. If people knew that there was a pre-sale where 80% of the tickets were being released during that pre-sale, and that information was publicly available, we believe that consumers will be able to make better informed decisions about how to make the best ticket buying decision that they can at the time. So I, again, appreciate the time that you've given us to come to talk about the ticketing industry and especially the transparency portion. And I also want to point out that the intent of transparency is not to change the way that the venue's operator, the promoters, create sponsorships and deals. We're interested in tickets being easily obtainable and transferable. To stifle the marketplace would only undermine our own existence. The intent is to give consumers the quality information that they need to make the best decisions that they can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Polian. Ms. Starzman.
I am Courtney Storsved. I'm the Director of Operations for Ticket King. We're a locally based ticket brokerage in Wisconsin and Minnesota. We have two local offices in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I'm here to talk a little bit about fraudulent tickets. With the new stadiums and Favre signing with the Vikings last year, this entire year has kind of focused in the news on fraudulent tickets in the secondary ticket marketplace. At Ticket King, we definitely strive to make sure that we can ensure the validity of our tickets for our consumers and that we can guarantee our tickets that they are valid. 90% of our tickets come from sources we've had longstanding business relationships with. They have a vested interest in ensuring that their tickets are legitimate because they want us to continue doing business with them. They also have to abide by certain industry regulations put in place by StubHub, Ticket Network, the National Association of Ticket Brokers. So on that end of things, we generally, there are so many rules in place that it's not an issue. Most people that are selling fraudulent tickets are looking to make a quick cash profit. They're looking to flip their tickets on the street. They don't want you to know who they are. So the majority of those transactions are going to take place either on the street or on a marketplace like Craigslist, where you can't enforce any kind of regulation on who's selling the tickets. When we're buying tickets from Joe Fan, you know, we require that a state-issued identification card is provided with the ticket so that we can keep information on file for all of our ticket holders. In the event that there were ever an issue with the tickets, we could come back sue that person and you know, take legal action against them. So people are much less likely to sell us a ticket that isn't legitimate. We also pay by check, so there isn't that quick profit. You have to actually go in and cash the check to get the money. It's a traceable means of payment. We also have pretty strong relationships with the venues and the teams. So if there ever is a question on whether or not a ticket is valid, we can call our representatives there and ask them whether or not the ticket has been reported as stolen or if there's been an issue with the season ticket account. Beyond that, we also have a pretty large quantity of tickets in our office that we can check to make sure that a ticket is legitimate, that it looks the same as the rest of the season tickets that have been issued by the team or the venue. If we ever have any inkling that a ticket is not valid, we just don't buy from that source. Because we have all of these regulations in place, we rarely see people that even come in to sell us illegitimate tickets. Between us and StubHub and eBay, we all have enforceable rules that prevent people from even wanting to get involved with our marketplace. You're much more likely to see, like I said, on Craigslist, on the street, in a place where you wouldn't see someone again, that's where you're going to see a fraudulent ticket. So I guess that's all I have, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you, for your testimony. We did go a little longer on the proponents, so I'm going to go a little bit longer with respect to the folks that have concerns about it. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got Ms. Swedberg, Mr. Carson, and Mr. Balser from Jam Productions, Excel, and Target Center. We caused a little musical chairs to occur in the. Thank you for joining us today. Who wants to lead off?
I'll start, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, colleagues. I'm Catherine Swedberg from Jam Productions, Minneapolis office. I'm the marketing director for Jam Productions, and as many of you probably know, Jam has presented concerts here in the Twin Cities for 38 years. I've been working there for the last 19, and I'm speaking on behalf of our coalition, the Entertainment and Sports Industry Coalition, members of Target Center, Excel, Historic Theater Group, State Fair, among others. And what I thought I would do today is just kind of give you a brief overview of what happens when a show is booked here in the Twin Cities. And really the first step is when an artist, manager, or agent approaches a promoter like Jam about a particular artist to come to a certain city. And we'll discuss with that artist's agent or manager which venue makes the most sense. And then as soon as we secure that venue, what we like to do is we devise what we hope is an effective marketing strategy. As promoters, we risk a large amount of money to bring these shows to the Twin Cities. And obviously, our objective is to sell as many tickets, well, every ticket, to every single show. So we use various methods to reach as many customers as possible. Frequently, we utilize promotional on-sales, sometimes referred to as pre-sales, to reach a targeted market. This is where a portion of the tickets are held back from the general on-sale and put up for sale online to groups such as the Artist Fan Club, the venue season ticket holders, the venue event newsletter people, and even Jam Productions' previous buyer lists. And that also includes radio station listener lists. Industry standards right now, artists usually allocate anywhere between 8% and 50% of the sellable capacity for the presale. And it is most often closer to 10%. It varies around 10%. And I just want to point out that these tickets are not the best 10% or the best 50% in the hall. We usually take every other row or one side of the venue or the other side of the venue. And I feel it's important to also point out that all of these groups in these pre-sales that are offered these opportunities are open to the general public. Most Arts Fan Club memberships cost very little or are even free. To get on the Jam Productions list, all you have to do is go to our website, give us your email, and when we have a pre-sale, we send you the link and the password, and you have the opportunity, the chance to purchase tickets. And then another maybe misconception is about pre-sales is that they all sell out immediately. The vast majority of these pre-sales do not sell out. And what happens with that inventory is it's put back into the general into the general on-sale inventory. Pre-sales are now considered an integral part of our on-sale campaign. And if a music fan wants to participate, it's easy to find a way to participate. So another thing I'd like to point out today is, in reality, shows, there are so few shows that sell out in just a few minutes. It caused the most controversy because everybody wants tickets to a show that, you know, they can't get tickets to. It's a simple math problem. What I'd like to impress upon you today is that the majority of complaints that I get from consumers are the fact that they can't get tickets to the hottest shows. That's the number one complaint. The second most popular complaint that I get is the complaint about the numerous tickets for sale at exorbitant prices to shows that are sold out. As promoters, we do not participate in the reselling of these tickets. We are not involved in the secondary market, and neither the artist nor the promoter profits from these sales. So, as promoters, it's in our best interest to be as consumer-friendly as possible. And as I said earlier, we want to sell every single ticket to every show that we put out there. But as I understand the proposed legislation, it doesn't assist the consumer in their attempt to purchase tickets. It simply benefits the reseller to manage their inventory and to how to price the tickets that they have or that they potentially might purchase to resell. Additionally, and I think this is very important, this requirement to disclose this information, which is considered proprietary information, may cause an artist to consider booking their show in another city or state that doesn't require it. And that, of course, is not what we as promoters, venues, or Minnesota music fans want to see happen. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swedberg. Who's up next, guys?
Hi, I'm Jack Larson. I'm the Vice President, General Manager of the Xcel Energy Center. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for inviting us here today to speak. I'd first like to thank the coalition that we put together, a group of people in this business, from the Target Center, Xcel Energy Center, Historic Theater Group, Minnesota State Fair, Northrop Auditorium, Rolls Presents, Jam Productions, Feld Entertainment, AEG Live, the Minnesota Twins, Vikings, Timberwolves, Wild, and Ticketmaster. It's a big group of people in this business, and we're working together to try to make sure we can sell these tickets as fast as we can for all the shows that we have. I work for Minnesota Sports and Entertainment. We own the Minnesota Wild. We also have Minnesota Swarm that we have at our venue. We do many events such as WCHA Final Five, four high school tournaments. We do WCHA, or we're going to do the NCAA Frozen Four next year, and we do many concerts. So we're a very busy facility. People love coming to the facility. They love to buy tickets to come to our events. We have a very large investment in the facility and the team, and obviously, with that investment, we need to make money to pay off that investment. We employ hundreds of people for each one of these events that come to the facility. Our teams and our events need to be successful. We need, which means we need to sell tickets. We need to sell every ticket we possibly can to every event. There's many parts of the operation that get involved in selling those tickets, including PR, marketing, and actually the box offices themselves. And our goal is to host as many events as possible and sell as many tickets as possible for all of those events. We host over 150 events a year and draw an average of 1.5 million people annually to the facility in downtown St. Paul. When we have an event that we're starting to work on, and we'll specifically talk about concerts, which Catherine was referring to, the promoter comes into the market, like she said, and chooses a facility, and then we start to work on that event with the promoter. There's a marketing plan that's put into place to figure out the history of the tour, how they've sold in the past, what price we should sell the tickets at, and how many we can sell at each price. And we put a marketing plan together to see how we can get and sell those tickets as fast as we can. And like Catherine pointed out, the promoter is the one that has the guarantee with the act, and so they need to know how many tickets they can get to before they're going to break even. A lot of times that number, I'm not going to speak for Catherine here, but that number can be as high as 90% of the tickets. So with an investment in the facility, an investment with the guarantee for the act, there's a lot of the reasons why we have to go out and try to find ways to sell tickets as fast as we can to whoever we can as soon as possible. One of the biggest selling points that we have is our facility sells tickets. It's a newer facility, and people like to come to downtown St. Paul, and they like to buy tickets to see events there. That's been proven over the 10 years of the facility. We're able to sell tickets and promote ourselves to promoters by the database that we have of interested buyers. People have bought tickets in the past for any type of event or specific to that genre of music. Our ticket provider, which is Ticketmaster, is an efficient and quick system to distribute tickets. I'll go into the Taylor Swift example that I believe somebody else brought up. There's probably 50,000 people that wanted to see that show or want to buy tickets for that show, and like it or not, only 15,000 people can get in to see that show. No matter what we do, no matter who we sell tickets to, wherever they come from, there's going to be 35,000 people that aren't going to be able to see that show, and they're not going to be happy, and we have to deal with that. And we try to distribute those tickets in the most fair way we possibly can. 80 to 85, 90% of tickets are sold over the internet these days. So the business has changed from where you used to have to stand in line, maybe overnight, with your tent, to wait to buy tickets that next morning. Right now, you can be in your pajamas at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning and buy those tickets over the internet.
Sometimes for our committee, people have to do that. We don't have the electronics. People have to put their tents out. Actually, earlier, I don't know if you guys sat through the whole thing, we had a good crowd. If we could have sold tickets here, we could have solved the state budget deficit. I'm sorry, Mr. Larson.
And just a couple of quick things about the show itself. We're probably going to do 24, 25 concerts this fiscal year. One of those shows sold out in minutes, and that was Taylor Swift. We had a few other sellouts, but they either took an hour, a few hours, or a day, or a few days to sell out. We're talking about one show here, I believe, when we're talking about the disclosure here. It just doesn't happen very often. We wished it happened every show. We want every show to sell out within minutes. The reality, it just does not happen. And we're working with the promoter and the act. Looking daily, every morning we have a call talking about how many tickets have sold, what can we do to sell more tickets, what do we need to change to sell more tickets. So this is not an exact science, but it's a very, very complicated marketing plan. So to sum it up, as Catherine stated, the proposed legislation does not help the consumer in purchasing tickets. Having to disclose the number of tickets available can in some ways be detrimental in marketing the sale of the event. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Balser, you got final word in a couple of minutes, because I know folks have to run to other meetings. Okay. We ran
I'll try to
over.
Be brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Balser. I'm the director of ticketing at Target Center Arena in Minneapolis, home of the Minnesota Timberwolves, Minnesota Lynx, and as Excel, numerous concerts and other family events. I've had over 10 years of experience in ticketing, same role in other venues as well. One of the major complaints that we get is why and how all the tickets are showing up on the secondary websites. In many cases, even before the event even goes on sale or any tickets have been sold off our system. It leads a lot of customers to believe that somehow the venues themselves are in cahoots with a lot of these brokers and kind of feeding them some tickets off to the side, which is absolutely not the case. The simple answer to this question is that these tickets that are posted before even we sell one ticket, all these tickets that are posted are speculative tickets. That's why in some instances when an event does sell out right away, people aren't able to buy it through our ticketing provider, Ticketmaster. They go over to the broker's website and they see thousands of tickets being posted. Not all these posted tickets are legitimate tickets. The majority of the posted tickets that you see on these websites are speculative tickets. If you would go to local ticket broker Ticket King's website, there's a disclaimer on their website. And it's on the purchase page when you purchase tickets for tickets that they're selling. The disclaimer reads, if the exact tickets I've chosen are unavailable, I will accept equal or better tickets if they're available at the same price. And in parentheses that says recommended. By making such statement, they're basically telling the people that are buying specific seats to events they're selling that in most cases you're not going to get these seats, but we're going to do our best to help facilitate you and get you equal or better seats if we can at the same price. It is important to note that this is recommended on their website, and actually the click box is already checked for you. You have to opt out of this option. The following examples are how speculative ticketing affects our industry and can create deception in the marketplace. On Friday, February 26th, Dave Matthews Band went on sale with 16 events through Ticketmaster. A week and a half prior to any tickets being sold through the primary market, on StubHub there were over 4,000 tickets listed for purchase, and on TicketKing there were 736 tickets listed. For the general consumer, they go to this website thinking they're going to be able to purchase these tickets, they're going to get these seat locations, and they think they're legitimate tickets, which in most cases they might be legitimate tickets. But in this instance, all of these tickets that are being posted are speculative tickets. These aren't actual legitimate tickets at all. Another example, Jimmy Buffett had 10 dates go on sale February 22nd through Ticketmaster. A week prior, without one ticket being sold on Ticketmaster or confirmed, there were 755 tickets listed on TicketKing's website alone. As this doesn't just affect the large venues, Excel and Target Center, it also affects smaller venues and theaters in downtown Minneapolis. The Orpheum Theater in downtown Minneapolis recently announced Shrek to be at their facility February 1st through 6th of 2011. Tickets for this event are scheduled to go on sale of December of this year. As of yesterday, there were 1,096 tickets listed on TicketLiquidator.com for their 8 runs of shows. Unfortunately, this is commonplace, and it's not just limited to these 3 events alone. It is also commonplace for seats that don't even exist within our facilities to be listed and sold on ticket broker websites. The FTC has recently taken note of this deception and included the following language in letters they recently sent to 10 major ticket resellers. And I'll quote from the letter. If any tickets sold on your website are not in hand and ready for immediate delivery to consumers, then disclosures should be presented clearly explaining either 1, that the ticket is not in hand but will ship by a particular date, or 2, that there is no ticket but rather the listing is offered to seek to procure one. The staff believes that this information is important to consumers and that failure to disclose it may violate the law. Unfortunately, in the end, it's up to the venue to deal with these issues that stem primarily from the secondary market. In my 10 years of working in the box office, the majority of the issues that stem from large sold-out events deal primarily with the secondary market, whether that be a counterfeit ticket that's sold on the street corner or through Craigslist, or a ticket broker not delivering the tickets that they had promised to a customer, or a ticket scalper making copies of the same ticket over and over again, selling it over and over to different customers. In the end, we're ultimately responsible for our guests to have a great experience in our venue. We're able to control the tickets that we sell and provide and assist with those customers. We do our best to assist in the customers that buy through the secondary market, but unfortunately there's only so much that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I know Representative Poppy wanted to ask if he could drop the bucket.
Would that be okay?
Already?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions, and a lot of them are pretty elementary, and I can probably get those answered better later. Let me just ask one quick question, and I think I understand this, but I don't know who best would answer this. If we're talking about ticket transparency, is this going to help people get tickets, or is it just going to help them understand why they didn't or where they could go to get them more quickly or more efficiently?
Anybody want to take a, or the author of the bill could, I could tell you what the author of the bill's intention was.
Okay.
Was just that, you know, if you go into a store and you see so many products on the shelf, if there aren't any products available to you, you know you're not going to be able to buy any. The point of it was, I think, very well intended, and that was that if, as a consumer, if I know my odds of getting a ticket are, you know, really minimal, that only 10% or 20% of the tickets, then I don't, my expectations are appropriate, and my my disappointment level is lessened. That's from a consumer's point of view. I have been educated highly by both sides since then, clearly both sides kind of sent their heavyweight team to come and visit with us, and I appreciate that. But if you all have a perspective on that question, we'd be happy to hear that as well.
Mr. Chairman, I'll answer. I don't think that it helps the consumer be able to purchase a ticket. It gives them information, but it actually might be detrimental when they do see, as you just mentioned, Mr. Chair, that, there's only this amount of tickets, so I'm not even going to bother. My goal is to sell all those tickets. I want everybody to try to get tickets. I don't want them to be disappointed or, you know, think, oh, well, I don't have a chance. I'm not going to bother. That's exactly what we don't want to do. So we want everyone.
Representative Hoppe, then Representative Sanders, and then I appreciate everybody sticking around beyond our normal time. I'll let you get out of here, but Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, this is all very illuminating, and I like this, and I'm assuming that this goes forward, you know, next year or later this year, interim or whatever. It'd be interesting to hear from Ticketmaster, one other perspective there, but both sides, I think this has been very interesting. Can I ask one hypothetical question? Let's just say Rush were going to be coming to the Twin Cities to State Fair.
Maybe
just hypothetically, if somebody wanted to get tickets for that, I don't know who it would be, but let's say somebody wanted to get, you know, a few tickets. Hypothetically, what would be the best way to go about doing something like that?
Hypothetically.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
nobody's really rushing to answer.
Call Ticketmaster.
All right. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real brief two comments. One, I share Representative Hoppe's thoughts on perhaps this moves forward. It would be great to hear from Ticketmaster themselves.
I thought you wanted Rush tickets, too.
No, I was.
I didn't know how to follow it.
Oh, that hypothetical person.
And secondly, I think as we're talking about transparency, we've definitely heard now that we want to, you know, transparency from the resellers. But I think it's fair that if we're going to go after transparency, that it's on both sides. So just a comment.
Okay. Thank you. Folks, and thank you very much. I know some folks came in from out of town. People took time out of their schedules, and I very much appreciate it on behalf of our committee. My sense as the author is it won't be moving forward this session, but this is clearly an issue that is important across the country and will likely continue to be important here, and we'll see more examples of things that may get our constituents' attention, therefore they get our attention. But we'll look forward to continuing the discussion. Thank you all very much, and with that, we stand adjourned.